August 10 is not observed as a federal holiday, an occasion for patriotic parades or shopping mall clearance sales. Banks do not close, and the mail is delivered on time. Ordinary Americans attribute no unusual significance to the date of August 10. Yet in the minuscule village of West Branch, Iowa, descendants, townspeople, and occasionally state dignitaries gather annually to pay homage to a man they consider the patron saint of their town, but whom much of America remembers as an economic Satan. Nonetheless, Herbert Hoover was one of the most extraordinary Americans of modern times. The kaleidoscopic range of his life's work, consisting of an almost unbroken record of success and offering writers and readers little fodder for criticism, would justify an inclusive biography even if Hoover had never become president. The most versatile American since Benjamin Franklin, Herbert Hoover led a life that was a prototypical Horatio Alger story, except that Horatio Alger stories stop at the pinnacle of success. As one of Hoover's earlier biographers wrote, "Truth does what fiction dares not try to do." Hoover personified the American dream. He extolled the first president born west of the Mississippi. He was the first to use radio during a campaign, the first to have a telephone on his desk in the Oval Office, and the first Commerce Secretary to reach the White House. He was summoned to service by more presidents than any other American chief executive, including Woodrow Wilson, Calvin Coolidge, Harry Truman, and Dwight Eisenhower. At his death, he had been awarded more honorary degrees than any other American. Most important, it is estimated that his relief efforts saved more human lives than those of any other individual in human history. Well, so opens Herbert Hoover A Life by Glenn Jeanson. It is quite an opening to a book, to a story about a man that our author says led an incredible life story. Still a reasonably young man, Hoover turned his hand to service to humankind, from his work helping to heal the ravages of World War I to his private work and private business, his service to Republican presidential administrations during the 1920s, and of course his four-year term as president from 1929 until the election of Franklin Delano Roosevelt in the midst of the worldwide Great Depression, set Hoover up for a life long to be remembered. Chapter after chapter lauds Hoover's insight, his intelligence, his immersion into the nitty-gritty problem at hand. Hoover was, our author states, a practical idealist above all else. His strong sense of public duty is attributed in part to his upbringing, and much of it associated with his Quaker upbringing. And indeed, Hoover was not the only Quaker to be elected president of the United States. But for many readers, the entire Herbert Hoover was a great U.S. leader begins to rattle and shake when we reach the middle chapters. For it is here, beginning with what was to become the auspicious year 1929, when our author takes up the one-term presidency of Herbert Hoover and spends, appropriately so, a large part of his text trying to explain away the many criticisms of President Hoover as a do-nothing president who could not have cared less about the personal turmoil sweeping the nation throughout the Great Depression of the 1930s. Attempting to explain and reconcile President Hoover's insistence on focusing his administration's efforts at relieving suffering and restarting economic growth by looking to local and state charities and politicians does express a point of view that places President Hoover into the cultural, intellectual, and political context of his time, an era in our national history which had never responded to a worldwide economic and social depression of such magnitude before. And certainly President Hoover was not alone. The economic depression he was battling was a worldwide phenomenon. As the author correctly points out, this was not the first economic downturn the United States had suffered during the decade of the 1920s. President Warren Harding's administration had responded to a significant recession after the conclusion of World War I, but that recession paled in contrast to the Great Depression that began in 1929. While noting the extraordinary circumstances that magnified the cultural and political effects of the Great Depression in the United States, and indeed much of the world throughout the 1930s, reflected through international cinema, a newly empowered news media that by the 1930s was being fed by almost instant news from transatlantic cable and, of course, radio. The rise of political demagogues at home and across Europe and Asia. Our author spends much more ink trying to place President Hoover's incrementally increased federal spending, real and far beyond any federal involvement in the national economy by any administration that came before him, and the development of the aforementioned local and state-based aid committees to spur local and state efforts into an almost modern-day conception of activist federal government action. But the thing is, President Hoover's actions at mobilizing an ongoing coordinated series of responses by those local state governments and not-for-profits to alleviate the worst of the Great Depression have been buried by popular history beneath the ad hoc but much more audacious, and popular history suggests ultimately successful, efforts of Hoover's charismatic successor, President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. His development of even more massive federal government intervention soon evolved into a widely accepted, if also deeply divisive, FDR solution to battle what has become known as the Great Depression, leaving President Hoover to be portrayed by other authors as a pale and bumbling ghost who supposedly did little to bring the nation out of its economic devastation. Today's author takes issue with that, however, and writes for several chapters throughout the middle of the book about the many activities that Hoover did engage in, both on the national and on the local level, writing at one point this: Hoover ultimately became the most activist president in the hard times until 1932 because he felt he had no choice. He said on February 3rd, 1931, that if state and local resources proved insufficient, quote, "I am willing to pledge myself, I will ask the aid of every resource of the federal government," end quote. Secretary of State Henry Stimson said that Hoover planned to summon a special session of Congress to provide for relief in 1931 if state and local resources proved inadequate. The president himself stated unequivocally that, quote, "I am willing to pledge myself that if the time should ever come that the voluntary agencies of the country together with the state and local governments are unable to find resources with which to prevent hunger and suffering in my country, I will ask the aid of every resource of the federal government, because I would no more see starvation amongst our countrymen than would any senator or congressman," end quote. Our author goes on to write, Hoover employed every weapon in his fiscal and humanitarian arsenal to combat the Depression in a multifaceted approach. Near the beginning of 1930, Hoover signed a $160 million tax cut designed to stimulate spending shortly before Christmas. He reduced appropriations for the Army and hoped to save money on the Navy. He hoped to redirect funds saved by arms reductions into social and economic programs that would spur economic growth. Throughout about 13 years of the New Deal that succeeded Hoover under FDR, there was not a single tax reduction intended to stimulate production, commerce, and consumption, though there were several tax increases, whereas billions were devoted to public works. The federal government provided the impetus, the expertise, and the leadership for projects to overcome unemployment. Yet in contrast to later federal reactions to economic downturns, Hoover considered the national government a partner with the states and with private enterprise in a coordinated, mutually beneficial effort. Hoover still believed that one of the lessons learned from the earlier downturns was that the construction industry was the balanced wheel of the economy. In the longer run, Hoover planned a systematic approach to building projects that lasted well into the future. The administration subsequently added 37,000 miles of highways and began to construct the Golden Gate Bridge in San Francisco. The federal highway budget doubled between 1930 and 31, and the number of workers employed on highways nearly tripled by the end of the Hoover administration. Construction began on the scenic Skyline Drive in Shenandoah National Park in Virginia. Workers were employed in national parks and forests, in path and trail building, reforestation, and fire prevention. Hoover established federal land banks to reduce farm foreclosures and home loan discount banks to protect homeowners from foreclosure. Hoover explained that he had a commitment to minimize the suffering, quote, to see that no deserving person in our country suffers from hunger or cold, end quote. The U.S. government had contributed by embarking on the greatest program in history involving construction of waterways, harbors, flood control, public buildings, highways, and airports. Hoover wanted to expand the program prudently without an increase in taxation, which would mean a counterproductive decrease in private employment and consumption. The government could only redistribute wealth. It could not create it. What it gave to some, it must first take from someone else. Yet, moving beyond his presidential years, if I may borrow from the mythology surrounding the ancient Julius Caesar, quote, all of Herbert Hoover's life can be divided into three parts: his life before the presidency, his presidency, and his life after. Herbert Hoover's post-presidential years, when the former president once again turned his considerable talents to international aid relief after World War II, as well as founding the Hoover Institution at Stanford, still a significant think tank in American cultural and political life, and an ongoing effort to cast his 4 years in the White House into a much more positive experience than it came to be popularly known, returns us, like the opening chapters, to a sympathetic and even plausible reading of Herbert Hoover's place in history. And given the reputation former President Hoover has come to have, this third part of our book is well worth some of your reading time. As a biography, Herbert Hoover, A Life, is a well-rounded, well-written story of the life of one of the great industrialists and public servants of his day. Coming from modest roots in turn-of-the-century Midwest America, he hails from Iowa, to counsel and immerse himself in matters of international importance. As a history, Herbert Hoover, A Life, is a well-grounded look at one of America's most disdained and, as our author would have it, misunderstood of presidents. As he concludes in his final paragraphs, because Hoover was frequently on the losing side of the ideological debates of the 1930s and 40s, historians have been too quick to leap to the conclusion that he was wrong on the merits of his causes, or even misguided to raise the arguments. Yet today, Hoover's ideas remain at the heart of American politics. In the 1980s, a groundswell of conservatism swept Ronald Reagan into power, reigniting the debate about big government, fiscal policy, welfare, overregulation of business, special interests, and endemic public spending. Hoover's concern that prodigious public debt would eventually paralyze the government in time of real need still resonates with voters. Although political prophets, like biblical prophets, are often scorned in their own lands, they are as necessary today as they were in Jeremiah's times. It is possible that the, quote, weaning of America, end quote, for which Hoover yearned, might still take place. Hoover remained proudly patriotic throughout his life, our author writes, yet he worried about the future of his nation during his declining years. He questioned whether America had become a country of sheep, splintered into selfish interest groups. In their seeking economic security as their chief priority, Hoover worried that they might shut the door to other values. Quote, freedom is the open window, he said, through which pours the sunlight of the human spirit, of human dignity, end quote. Our author concludes, Hoover's life was one of undeniable accomplishment and indefatigable industriousness, even in lost causes. But most important about his life were his ideas, his ideals, his character, which stand undiminished generations after his death. For him, there was no substitute for hard work and perseverance. In almost any pursuit, drive was more important than intelligence. Herbert Hoover did not gain the whole world, but neither did he lose his soul. Herbert Hoover, A Life, a fascinating look and an updated look at a man who has long been considered not one of our greatest presidents. Today's author tries to show us that there's a lot to admire in Herbert Hoover, the man both before, during, and after his controversial presidency. Herbert Hoover, A Life, by Glenn Jeanson. It's available at all of our local fine public libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.